Hello and welcome to another episode of Doom to Bloom podcast. Today we have a special guest, Jeff Higgins, on the screen with me here. And we're going to have, I feel like, a juicy conversation. But first, I just wanted to introduce you, Jeff, to the listeners. Is there anything that we should let the listeners know about Jeff before we start?
Hey, yeah, thank you for having me. It's great to be here today. What you should know about Jeff before. Jeff is what we used to say, WYSIWYG, right? That was like a computer screen. It's what you see is what you get. So I take a very it's personal to me to be who I am, where I am, and so you get all of me all the time.
So basically, that means you're nothing but Jeff, which is great.
Yeah, right.
Always Jeff.
And I've learned that over the years, right? It's well, and it's also about transparency. You'll see through my story here. I believe transparency is so important for us. And I'll tell you a story to kind of illustrate that, Jacqueline. My older brother, he was like 8 years older than me. His name was Tim. He was kind of a violent guy, right? He is very troubled. Punched holes in the walls of our house. And one time my mother, I remember her poignant memory from when I was a little boy, taking a smiling picture of our family and hanging it over the hole that Tim had punched in the wall. And I think that that's, what we do a lot of times is and rightly so, right? I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. We go along with the smiling face sometimes, but deep down inside there's stuff going on. In order to fix the hole, it's important to take down the smiling picture. So that's why, for me, that's kind of illustrative of, why it's so important that healing happens when we're transparent with each other. And you talk about doom to bloom, right? If you're going to go from doom to bloom, it's usually, is part of a community of other people who have been through difficulties like you have.
And it shows like kind of the darkness to the light, and that shift that you mentioned of just healing and what that journey looks like.
That's right. That's
And the
right.
transformation.
And somebody who's been there, if you take down that smiling picture every now and then with people who understand, well, that's when healing really happens. And so, transparency has always been very important to me. So yeah, I'm WYSIWYG, so to speak.
Great. Well, that's exactly what I'm asking for our conversation. So I'm getting exactly what I wanted. So you mentioned you have a story, as we all do. What part makes sense to start at for you, Jeff?
Oh, probably at the beginning, and you bring up a really good point. We all, I think, have a story. Very few of us don't, and if you don't, you probably will before it's all said and done.
Such is life.
Yeah, right. Now, I had a friend tell me once, yeah, we all have, ups and downs in life. My story is dramatic. And I caution you up front, don't compare your story to my story. You may be able to, or you may not be able to relate to the struggles and the difficulties that I've had, but it really doesn't matter because struggle is struggle, and we all have struggles. Every day, little struggles build up to be big struggles. So it doesn't have to be dramatic. We're all under everyday assault from life. In one way or another, and some days are better than others, but it comes at us fast and furious, and sometimes it throws us a curveball, and it affects us all, right? I read the newspaper. The levels of stress, anxiety, depression in this country are higher than they've ever been, even suicide. I know that we all have those daily things that beat us down. And so yeah, I like to use my struggles are kind of dramatic. I started when I was young. I had a family of five, right? My older brother and sister. I told you about Tim. He was 8 years older. Krista, she was 6 years older. Mom and dad and myself. And what I didn't realize until later on, because family doesn't talk about this stuff. Tim and Krista were from mom's first marriage. So I found out many, many years later, I was the proverbial stepchild, right? I was that younger little kid from the new marriage. And so Tim and Krista, they abused me physically. And mom was an alcoholic. So our home was broken in a lot of ways, and it was very difficult. Like I said, Tim was in and out of trouble all the time. A lot of violence in our, middle class home. We had a good living, but our home was definitely broken. Mom's alcoholism finally caught up with her when I was 11 years old. She drove her car the wrong way on the highway and under the rear tires of a semi trailer, where she died at the young age of 30,
Wow.
the young age of 38 years old. And as you can imagine, that devastates in a little 11-year-old boy, and had ramifications long, many years later in my life that I didn't even realize. My older brother Tim, excuse me, while I while he abused me, I guess I didn't know that at the time, but he was my older brother. I loved him, and I looked up to him, even if I was kind of annoying to him sometimes. But he he lived fast and furious, and he ended up with a what was left of a six pack on his floorboard and a beer can in his hand as he drove under a merging semi on the highway. He was 22 years old, and I was 14 at that time. So by the age of 14, I'd suffered a lot of tragic circumstances in my family. The alcoholism, the abuse, the sudden tragic deaths of my mother and my brother. And it would be nice if you just said, "Hey, but I came through it, right?" But no, I didn't handle it well. I didn't know how to handle it well. And despite sending me to a myriad of professionals, I pretty much was just checked out of life. But April the 6th, 1983 changed all of that in the cafeteria of Milford High School. Spaghetti was on the menu, and I met Shelley.
So romantic.
And we've been together ever since. We've built a beautiful life together. And Shelly drove me, and she got me out of that. And I think as with a lot of people, I turned my pain into purpose. There's five stages of grief, right? There's denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance, right? And I find that people oftentimes, you don't go through, and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, when she wrote that, never meant you go from here to here to here. It doesn't work that way, right? It's like we spend time in each of these compartments, in my
And
opinion.
sometimes you go back and forth. It's not linear by any means.
And a lot of people, get stuck in depression or anger. The only one of those five stages that really is a good place to be is in acceptance. And another really important thing, and the reason I'm telling you this is because after Elizabeth Kubler-Ross passed away, based on their work together, her protege David Kessler wrote a book about finding meaning and purpose, the sixth stage of grief. That oftentimes, and this makes a lot of sense, right? You look around you, a lot of times people find meaning and purpose in their life because of their difficulties. And that's kind of what happened with me. I got involved with teaching senior high Sunday school for 17 years. I led youth groups. I helped in the community. Purpose or service became a real purpose for me. I always said, if you're going to do something big, attach it to something bigger. So at 50 years old, I decided I was going to climb Mount Rainier. Since Seattle, Washington, it's a mountain with glaciers. You don't take a tram to the top of this thing. It's got crevasses and dangers, and people die up there. But it's 14,000 foot high mountain, and I thought I wanted to do that, and I used that as an occasion to raise $25,000 for a special needs school in rural Guatemala for some missionaries that we.
Wow.
And so climbing the mountain, yeah, it was a big deal and it was a cool thing in my life. And I've got the pictures, but it was made ever more important to me, ever more meaningful to me because it had purpose attached to it. I knew that I was climbing that mountain. They were going to have to carry me off of that mountain before I would give up, right? And it was hard. And they were going to have to carry me off because I had a purpose, right? Those kids were. on me, the people that supported me. I had all the letters in my backpack of the people that were supporting me and donated to me. So it went well beyond just the vain endeavor of a middle-aged man to climb a mountain and get pictures, right? And that purpose, I think, gives us is so important in life. I'll tell you a quick story before I go on with my own. A friend of mine, John, used to be a cop, and he tells me that he found it curious that he was oftentimes with people in their last moments of life. He said, and in the last 30 seconds, they usually said the same two things. I wish I had more time, and did I make a difference? Regret and wanting to know that they served a bigger purpose on this planet. It is so basic to who we are as human beings. I believe that having meaning and purpose in the things that we do, and maybe not even knowing your meaning and your purpose, but finding meaning and purpose in the things that we do every day. And that oftentimes can lead us to our meaning and purpose. So anyway, so I summited Mount Rainier. If you'll excuse me, sorry about that. I don't have a cough button.
we'll tell Zoom to add one.
Yeah, right. Cover up my microphone. Yeah, you know, and I went to the ribbon cutting for the Center of Hope in Guatemala. That was in February of that next year. And after I came home, and to give you an example, I was talking about earlier about the stages of grief, my sister, older sister, Krista, I hadn't talked about her much. She was troubled too. And she did not deal properly with, in her mind, with the deaths of our brother and sister. She too was an alcoholic. And she used alcoholism and self-pity. And frankly, those two together are rocket fuel for killing yourself. And, you know, she was often in the hospital. One time I visited her and I pleaded with her with tears in my eyes. I said, you know, Krista, I've had to bury Mom and I've had to bury Tim. Don't make me have to bury you too. Well, she broke the promise that she made to me that day when I was called to the hospital that March after the ribbon cutting in Guatemala. And the only decision left was really to remove life support. And I had to make that decision. I spent most of the next 3 days with her while she died. And I was alone with her when she breathed her last breath. And I think that that's a warning. It has been to me. That along with other things to those of us, you know, that have difficult, extremely difficult situations in life. And those can be very painful and very difficult, and you don't know how you can go on. But if you find a way forward, you have to make sure you don't get stuck, you know, don't get stuck in that. I see a lot of stuff on the internet. Grief never goes away. Well, no, maybe it doesn't. It's always with us. It's part of it makes me who I am, right? But if you get stuck in the wrong parts of grief, it can be devastating. Mm-hmm. About 3 months after Krista died, I was golfing with my friend, Father Chris. And Chris and I love to golf. Chris liked to golf so much, he once said he wanted to die in a sand trap. He told some fellow priests that. And so, and he and I love to golf, and we love bourbon, and we love the Bible, you know. So when we went out golfing, we'd have a great time. We were together almost every weekend during the summer. I was golfing with him one day, and he said, you know, you haven't ever taken me for a ride in your car. So after we got done, we had some extra time, and we went for a ride in my car, and that ride lasted less than 10 seconds when I ended up down an embankment, upside down in a sand trap, where my friend Chris died. So within a year of summiting Mount Rainier, I was lower and more broken than I ever imagined a human being could be. The story was fairly popular in the press. I was, of course, indicted, ended up pleading guilty to vehicular manslaughter, and I was sentenced to 3 months in jail, among other various fun things and goodies, probation and all that. And yeah, you know, I don't know how to explain the depth of what I felt at the time, other than this verse that I highlighted. This is my Bible from jail. And I highlighted this verse on December the 9th, 2017. Why does God bother giving light to their miserable? Why bother keeping bitter people alive? Those who want in the worst way to die and can't, who can't imagine anything better than death, who count the day of their death and burial as the happiest day of their life. What is the point of life when it doesn't make sense and when God blocks all the roads to meaning?
That gave me goosebumps.
What's that?
It gave me goosebumps.
Yeah, right. And that's from The Message. So it's a little bit different verbiage than a lot of Bibles. But yeah, you know, you can come back from that. Life does change and life does happen really fast. And sometimes, you know, things happen that are self-inflicted. Sometimes they just happen. And it can hurt and it can be very devastating for us as people. But I'm here to tell you that 6 years to the date after I summited Mount Rainier, August 11th, 2022, I got my driver's license back. And as I held that driver's license, it felt every bit like being on the summit of Mount Rainier. Since then, I had been through the most difficult, lowest valleys that I could ever have imagined, but I had come back. And I want to encourage everybody that I talk to. I know it seems bleak sometimes. It's like, what's the point when God blocks all the roads to meaning? But that you can move on. You can move on to meaning and purpose in your life, even after life's most difficult situations. Just keep making the one step at a time. It's like climbing that mountain, Mount Rainier, right? One step at a time. And eventually you look up and there's the summit.
I always, just to add on to you, Jeff, I always say, you know, when people are struggling, it's sometimes people say one day at a time or one week at a time, 1 month at a time. But yeah. For the step analogy, I always say, doesn't matter how big or how small or drastic that step is, a step is still a step.
Exactly. Exactly. Just, you know, concentrate on making a good step. Mm-hmm. It might be small. Just keep making those steps, you know? And yeah, that's a popular saying, you know, one day at a time, I didn't mention it, but, you know, after the accident, my own alcoholism kicked into high gear. Getting sober was a big part of, you know, coming mm-hmm. back. Yeah, I had to move on from that. And that was a painful process. But yeah, you know, that's what they say in AA, you know, one step at a time, one day at a time, one day at a mm-hmm. time. And absolutely. And sometimes for me, it was one breath at a time. You know, when you're laying on the floor, trying to hold yourself together, having a panic attack, feeling like you're going to die. Mm-hmm. It's one breath at a time.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's all we have in us, but yeah. We kind of stick to what we do have, right?
Right, right. Exactly.
The one breath, the one smile, the one cup of coffee we look forward to, the one step, whatever it is, that one thing could be big or small is what sometimes keeps us going forward.
Right, right. Just keep moving forward, though. You know, don't get stuck. Don't stop. If you stop, you're not going to make it to the summit.
And maybe to play a little devil's advocate with you,
sure.
When you say don't get stuck, just keep going forward. What, maybe hypothetically, mm-hmm. would you say to somebody if they were not necessarily stuck and they were moving forward, but they weren't moving forward in a positive, healthy way? Would you still say keep moving forward?
Oh, that's moving backward. Yeah. You know, and I want to be clear about this too, right? When you're going through it, when you're in the middle of the fire, nobody wants to hear, you know, well, you're going to be, what doesn't kill us makes us stronger and there'll be a better day tomorrow. No, that is not the time for that, right? When you're going through it, right, you just need a hug.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody to listen if you want to. right? But don't give advice when somebody is going through the day. And I see a lot of people who are unfamiliar, they're well-intentioned and well-meaning, you know, tell people, people who have little experience going through difficult, tragic situations. And they struggle. They struggle to comfort those. But those things, you know, there's a time for that. There's a time to move forward. There's a time to make those steps, right? And I'm a firm believer that, hey, you know, whatever size step it is, keep making steps, because some days you can make big steps, and some days you're lucky to make little ones, right? But as long as you keep moving forward, yeah.
Still a step is a step.
Yes.
Can we delve deeper in, if you're comfortable, Jeff, into what the support with sobriety looked like to getting to that point, and just throughout all of the grief and trauma you've experienced, like what your healing journey actually looked like and still probably looks like?
Yeah. For sobriety, for sobriety, it's very interesting. You know, people who don't understand alcoholism, and I can mostly speak towards alcoholism. We alcoholics don't make much sense to them. And I will tell you that alcoholism doesn't make sense, even to us, right? I have three identical headstones for immediate family members, all dying from one form or another because of alcoholism. Mm-hmm. And I've got those to stare me in the face, and I'm drinking. And it really, you know, for me, the one thing that I did have, the advantage I did have, was those examples that I said I would never end up like that. I would never end up like Mom, like Tim, like Krista. Mm-hmm. So my basement wasn't as low as most people. You know, I did reach that. It was after the accident, probably 3 years after the accident. And there's a great story there, if I could, about my sobriety. That I believe that God is working things out oftentimes behind the scenes, and we just don't know it. And, mm-hmm. This story is kind of an example of that. That when my mom died from an alcoholic car accident when I was 11 years old, my dad became good friends with the funeral director. The funeral director had three sons. His middle son became my good friend, and he and I, you know, he kind of kicked my little budding alcoholism partying into high gear, right? Not blaming my alcoholism on him. I'm just saying, you know, that was all I needed, was somebody to encourage me. And man, I was off to the races after that. Fast forward, you know, when I was ready to get sober, and my wife had called an ambulance and taken me to the hospital, and you know, I knew that that I was, and if I didn't change something quick, I was going to be the fourth headstone in my family. Mm-hmm. And so you know, she said to me, she said, back up a little bit after the accident, and I forgot this part of the story, and it's important. After the accident, a couple of years, maybe a year after the accident, a guy reached out to me, and his name was Don, and he was Eric's older brother, right? So he was the oldest of the three brothers of my best friend, who was even the best man at my wedding, right? This is his older brother, barely knew the guy. You know, I was that pesky little brother's friend that came by the house, and he reached out to me, and we grew a relationship, and I come to find out that he's involved in AA, and I'm like, yeah, that's all right, I don't have a problem. But you know, we became friends, and finally, when I was ready to get help, my wife said, is there somebody you want me to call? And I said, yeah, call Don, right? So Don comes over to my house, and he's sitting there. He says, so you want to go to a meeting? And I said, yeah, I'd like to go to a meeting. I said, let me go get straightened up here, go to the bathroom, and I'll come out. So I go to the bathroom, and sitting on the coffee table there is my Bible, my jail Bible. Excuse me. And And he has it open when he comes back, and he has this highlighted. Excuse me, I'm sorry. From Romans 8. And again, this is a very different translation, but he's got it open and he's reading this. He says, I want you to see this. And actually, it's the translation I really like. He says, and so I read it and it said, God's spirit beckons. There are things to do and places to go. This resurrection life you have received from God is not a timid, grave-tending life. It is adventurous, expectant, greeting God with a childlike, what's next, Papa? He said, look, somebody's even highlighted that for you. And I said, yeah, I know. That's the verse that I underlined in my Bible, and I have it dated on December the 12th or December the 25th, Christmas Day in jail. That was the verse that I highlighted in my Bible. And I never looked back from there. Don, and in a lot of ways, the death of my mother from alcoholism when I was a little boy set the stage for me getting sober when I was in my 50s. And I'm thankful for that. Don came into my life and was led me to AA. And I found AA. I knew nothing about it, and I found it to be an incredible resource. And frankly, it helped me to understand. It helped me to understand a lot more about my mom and my brother and my sister, why they were the way they were, and why I couldn't change my sister as much as I tried. And I always felt a certain amount of maybe guilt over that. AA for me and getting sober was it was in many ways cathartic for me.
What is your sober date? Do you know one, or do you celebrate one?
Absolutely. July 8, 2020.
Incredible. So you're almost coming up to 4 years soon.
I am very soon
That's
here.
incredible.
4 years.
Incredible.
I'm
And
thankful,
how
and it before I got sober is like I would break out into cold sweats thinking about not drinking for the rest of my life. I'm like, no, I can still drink a little bit. They disabused me of that idea. But as I sit here today, I'm living my best life ever. I do not have the desire to drink again. I'm not saying that won't come back, but yeah, I'm happily sober, and I never would have guessed it.
How, okay, couple of things. How
Sure.
did your peers, maybe the ones that are super close to you, so maybe your wife and, other close family and friends, and kind of outside of that immediate circle, how did everybody, if they did support you with the sobriety? Because I feel like there's a lot of stigma with addiction when it comes to drugs or sex or gambling or other things. But when it comes to alcohol, it's kind of normalized in a sense. And it, like, I choose to not drink by choice. And even still to this day, it's like, oh, we'll just have one. One's not going to hurt you. One's not going to do anything. Just have another one. Or, well, you're no fun. You don't drink anymore. Whatever. Did you experience a lot of those too?
No, not really. Today, though, if you go someplace with a grouper and you say, yeah, I'll have ice water, everybody kind of looks at you and, wink, wink. I get, oh, he's one of those. No, not for me. I tell you, the hardest thing is, as alcoholics, we do a lot of damage. There's a lot of wreckage in our path. And the hardest thing is for me, and I think for a lot of people, is the fact that you have to live down some of those resentments from those around you that you love, that you've hurt very deeply. And time does heal those wounds. It's a painful reminder at times of what we've done.
And how have you worked through a lot of that hurt and healing from that journey?
I
Or
would,
have you? Maybe that's the question. Yeah.
well, hey, none of us arrives. Okay. I talk about mental health and well-being and ways that we can help ourselves and improve ourselves. And as there, none of us, in my opinion, arrives and says, I'm there, I'm good. It's a daily thing that you work on. One of the biggest things is or resentments. That's one of the things that they talk about a lot in AA. But yeah, one of the biggest things is being able to, in my opinion, what I tell people is forgive radically. That is, forgive everything. And I do mean everything. And when I say that, a lot of people probably cringe. There's a lot of very deep wounds out there, and I know that. And there's probably 1,000 but they and but he but she and I get that. I get that. But it's up to you. You know, it's a decision you have to make. If you want to have peace and peace of mind in your life, I really think that you know, practicing radical forgiveness is essential to that. In my own case, you know, I decided that while I was in jail, right? So the damage I caused as an alcoholic, that's only part of it. I mean, I'm responsible for a man's death, my good friend's death, you know, a guy who was loved by thousands of people. You know, there's so many things. You know, I had the forgiveness of myself was first and foremost, but I knew that if I was going to have a life worth living, frankly, and when you're stuck in one of those other four stages, it's like purgatory or something. I think that's worse than being all one way or the other, but you know, I knew that I was going to have to forgive anything and everything. That started with my family, myself, my circumstances, the press, you know, whatever. So I had decided that early. Well, there was this guy that during my trial, right, he made it his job to try to make sure that I got crucified. All right. And those are his words, not mine. And he was talking to the press. I was on the front page a couple of times. He was talking to the prosecutor. He was talking to Chris's family and stirring up a lot of bitterness. A couple of years after I got out of jail, this guy, his name is Gary, he reached out to me, right? And he left me voicemails, cryptic, sent me a letter. And my attorney says, yeah, you're on probation still. You probably don't want to call this guy back. He did, you know, he was not our friend. He did a lot of damage. But I felt compelled to reach out to this guy. So finally I called him and I talked to him and he wanted my forgiveness. He wanted reconciliation between us. And the reason is he was terminal. He was dying. And so this one of those things that he wanted to set straight before he died. Now, I think there's even a country song about this. This is nothing new, right? Many of us want to reconcile those types of things before we die, right? Mm-hmm. And it's because we want to die in peace. Absolutely. Every one of us does. I support that. Doesn't it follow that if we want to live in peace, we should do the same thing?
Mm-hmm.
That's why I forgive. I forgive radically. I forgive 1,000 times a day to the guy that's rude to me at the grocery store checkout, whatever it is. You know, if I feel that resentment, you know, I'm on the forgiveness train and it's very important. And I feel like it brings me great peace in my life.
So how else have you worked to heal yourself aside from I'm going to assume, and correct me if I'm wrong, but forgiveness is huge,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
That's a fundamental piece of healing. But what else did you do on that healing journey?
Yeah, you know, and I talked about having purpose. Mm-hmm. I think having purpose is vital. It's important. It's basic to who we are. Forgiveness, you have to make the decision, right? You have to make the decision. It's either bitter or better. Or is this going to be a stumbling block or a stepping stone? Mm-hmm. But also very important, gratitude. Very important to our mental health and well-being is gratitude, right? And there's a myriad of studies, you know, about thankfulness, about mm-hmm. forgiveness, and about gratitude. and how much it helps us. It helps anxiety. I mean, depression, every. So, gratitude, it's right there, but I don't know why more people don't preach this, right? Every night before I go to bed, I'm going through the things that I'm thankful for that day. And this doesn't come natural for me. I'm not a very grateful type person normally, right? I'm not at work. I'm not the boss who's always telling you what a great job. I'm not great at that, right? So this has worked for me, but every night that's what I do. And I feel that it's vital. It's vital to maintaining our sense of mental health and wellness.
And does your wife, not that necessarily her trauma or whatever has happened with her life impacts your healing, but are you both on kind of a healing journey together? Do you both journal and do gratitude and practice faith and all of that kind of stuff together?
Yeah, I don't know that we do it together, but we have a lot of those transparent conversations. She finds her own way, but yeah, she's an incredible woman, and yeah, I'll tell you a story, Jacqueline, and I'm not sure if it fits or not, but it just shows you. I think it taught me an important lesson. A couple days after the accident, we were sitting in my in bed talking, in the morning, and Shelley, just kind of contemplating the horror of what had just happened, right? And she looks at me and she says, "We've tried to set an example of how to live during the good times. We should also now have to set an example of how to live during the difficult times." And I think that that's very very important, and it's not easy to do. But that's when people really look at you. It's not during the easy times. It's not during the prosperous times as much as they're really looking at you when you're going through the difficult times. And how do you handle that? And I can't say that I always did everybody proud in that area, but I think that that's good advice to follow. And one of the things that she did is, when I was in jail, I used to get a lot of letters, right? And this is part of the healing journey. You talked about the healing journey. And pardon me. That was very unusual. Most of the inmates didn't receive a lot of letters. I was in the protective custody pod. So all the excuse me, we talked about cussing, snitches and bitches, right? These are rapists. These are child molesters. These are one guy was a cop that got heroin addicted and robbed a convenience store. We're right next to the murder pod. General population, also known as the zoo, is right next door, right? So I'm there, and I'm clearly, well, I was later voted the whitest guy in the jail, right? I don't fit in. I don't have any ink. I don't walk right. I don't talk right. And I'm just keeping to myself and trying to stay out of trouble, right? Finally, one day I came back to my bunk and there's a brownie, a fruit cup, and two bags of barbecue potato chip because I wasn't getting commissary for at least another week. And the food there was awful and I wasn't eating. And somebody anonymously left that for me on my bunk in my cell. Another guy offered me a pencil to write letters, another guy some paper, another guy said, "Here's some books." And my wife, when I was telling her about this, she said, "Wow, that's amazing." And this is the duality of jail, right? There's community in jail, and community is so important. And so she decided, and she looked them up on the website, the Claremont, or I'm sorry, the Hamilton County Justice Center website. Anybody can do this with their local jail. She got their inmate number and wrote them letters and thanked them for their kindness towards me and told them that she was praying for them in their situation. One guy,
Wow.
yeah, one guy, his name was Preacher, who, if you saw Preacher coming at you on the street, you'd probably go over to the other side. He was a bad looking dude, but I was good with Preacher, and my wife sent him a letter, and he comes to me one day. This guy's got seven numbers and he's holding that letter for my wife, and he has tears. And he says, I've been here for 7 months and I haven't got one letter. Tell your wife thank you. I really appreciate it. So when we talk about growing and healing together, it happens in community.
Mm-hmm.
It was those people that were writing me letters. It was a group of really messed up guys in jail. It was my wife reaching out to people she had no idea. And, you know, sometimes it is your spouse, but a lot of times it's not. Like in AA, she can't understand my alcoholism either, right? But that's where healing happens. And I talked earlier about transparency. Yeah, transparency is important in community. And I don't mean Facebook community. I mean people who know what you're going through, have been through what you've been through. That's where real healing happens.
How did you work through, you mentioned being in the press a lot, which I'm assuming, again, correct me if I'm wrong, probably led to a lot of things being said about you and your family and probably stigma. How did you work through that? Was it radical forgiveness or was there other pieces to that?
Yeah. You know, that's a very humbling experience, Jacqueline. Let me tell you, to have the worst moment of your life on the front page of the newspaper. Yeah, you know, and at the time, there was so much going on. All I can do is clean up my side of the street. You know, we talk about that in AA. All I can do is clean up my side of the street. I think that there's probably still a lot of bitterness towards me out there. And I understand that. And I accept that. There's nothing I can do about that, you know, except move forward and, yeah, love me or hate me. This is who I am. For me, as a Christian, I am pure, holy, and blameless. That's what God tells me. And that's the way I intend to live my life.
Did you always believe it at the time when it was happening? Or is that kind of the healed part of Jeff that worked through all of that?
Yeah, that's more the healed part, probably. You know, at the time, it's like you just want to crawl in a hole and die, you know, because you feel all of this ill will towards you out there. You know, it was almost palpable that I could feel that. So at the time, you just, you know, you want the worst way to just go away somewhere where, you know, just kind of like the opposite of Cheers. I remember saying at the time, right now, it's like, for me, it's the opposite of Cheers. I want to go where nobody knows my name. I'm getting on an airplane the day of, I'm on the front page of the newspaper, and I'm like, God, nobody notices me. It was a special kind of hell.
But day by day, breath by breath, step by step, you did it, and you're here.
Yeah. And for me, you know, that gave me perspective too. You see people in the newspaper all the time. And let me tell you, a lot of times you ain't getting the whole story, number one. But number two, there's another story behind the scene there. And boy, you know, I've got a lot of empathy for people who have their dirty laundry dragged through the press. It's not a fun situation. It's not a fun feeling. And it's often unfair, you know. So, yeah. I have a special spot in my heart when I see articles in the newspaper. I'm like, oh man, that poor person just got crucified, you know?
And a lot of times too, media in general, I think it's safe to say, wants to emphasize how bad it was and use that as like a deterrence to for nobody else to do that, right? And so for them, they're going to tear you apart, make you look like the complete monster, and then publish it, right?
Yep. Clickbait. It was good clickbait for a while. I was good clickbait.
And then I think that also, for the most part, happens in jails and prisons too, where they're all stigmatized based on what they did, even though maybe at that time it wasn't, you know, maybe it was heroin or maybe it was alcohol induced or psychosis or schizophrenia or bipolar. Like there's so many different things, right? Everybody goes through things of some sort.
You know, a lot of it, the heroin, you know, you talk about that. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but man, you
That's
hit on
okay.
a real nerve for me. You know, I'd say 80% of those people in jail, those men that I was with, it's either because they were doing heroin, they did something because they were on heroin, or they were, you know, it's something to do with some kind of opiate addiction. That cop that I knew, he got addicted to heroin and robs a convenience store. He's a cop for freaking sake. You know, it's a scourge in this country, and I'm not sure people appreciate how awful it really is.
Well, I think people are just, in my opinion, really, 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 really quick to judge based on what they see at face value and not necessarily what they know or how they feel about it, if that makes sense. They just, oh, John uses heroin, so he must be violent and this and this and this, right?
Right.
But in doing a lot of work within the social services, I've learned that the root of addiction is always trauma. Some way, somehow, some shape, whatever it is, it's always trauma that led them into that substance. It's coping.
Yeah, it is.
And alcohol is the same. It's just more normalized and more, I don't know what the word would be, but more normalized in society kind of makes us feel like something's wrong if we don't drink, but something's wrong with you if you use drugs. So
Right.
it's a contradiction,
Yeah.
conflict.
Yeah, it is. And you know, the addiction issues, you know, in this country are so pervasive. But the opiates are the ones in my mind that are just so awful. You know, most of those guys, you know, young guys, and they used to like to compare the pictures that were on our ID bracelets from when we got input, right, to how they are today. And they usually gain, you know, a lot of weight, and they, you know, they look normal. And you look at the picture on their bracelet, and it's scary. But yeah, you know, and they will go right back to it, a lot of them. Yeah.
Until you deal with the underlying, there's always the coping part at the end, right?
Yep. And AA, you know, it's a lot about resentments, that forgiveness thing I was talking about. Very much about that.
I feel like in the larger sense of population, there's a lot of people that just don't, maybe not necessarily that they don't want to, but maybe they don't know how, but forgiveness is something that I don't hear about it very often. And I don't see people practicing it.
No, everybody likes to get it all worked up and wound about the axle about everything these days. Everybody's so sensitive and looking for chances to be offended. It's counter to what we see these days. And that's one of the reasons I bring it up, because it is so important. And I just don't hear a lot of people talking about it. You know, this is the stuff that therapists ought to be talking about.
There's maybe another new project for you.
Yeah, right.
Aside from the school fundraising, now
Yeah.
it's time to focus on that. I know, Jeff, that we've touched on a lot of different topics and a lot of parts of your story. And I guess some concluding, maybe final thoughts for you. I really appreciate you being on, sharing your story, being vulnerable. Talking about the parts that maybe you didn't like about yourself, that others didn't like about you, and working through all of that and being vulnerable enough to share it. Because as I've said to you and to others, it literally just takes one conversation for somebody else to maybe not feel as alone or not feel as isolated or as hurt or as suicidal or as fill in the blank, right? And so I really wanted to give a big kudos to you for still being here today and for working on the sobriety and just the healing in general, because it is a journey. It's not just a, couple year thing. It's definitely a journey. And also a final question for you. I know through a lot of our conversation, you've shared a lot of golden nuggets and just words of wisdom and support and encouragement for anybody that has struggled with anything that we've touched on or is supporting somebody who struggled with those, do you have a final piece of advice or word of encouragement or support that kind of comes to mind when I ask that?
So I've got a really incredible story that I like to tell. When my mom died, at her funeral, they read Romans 8:28, which says that God can make all things. I know a lot of people have a hard time swallowing this. All things work for good. For those who love him and are called according to his purpose. And that verse got branded on my heart that day for some reason. And that's, one of the reasons that one of the things that motivated me in my younger years to use my difficult situations and my tragic situations to as something good. I wanted it to mean more than just, I didn't want to be defined by that. Fast forward, when I was being processed into the Hamilton County Justice Center, I was put in a holding cell with three other young black men who weren't dressed like me. They were sitting there, I'm sitting on a concrete bench with my head down, just, wondering how the heck did I get in this situation. And they're talking about all the shootings they've been involved in. And they're, they're obviously gang members, different part of town than I'm from. We couldn't have been more different. And the one guy starts talking about why he's there. And he says he had a car accident, and his 11-year-old son was in the car with him when he died. And he died. And tears started coming to his eyes. And as he told this story, I looked up from that concrete bench in the coma that I was in. And I said, "Man, I get you. I understand. I know what you're going through." And we cried and we hugged. And we couldn't have been from two more different places. And as I was there, I said to him, "God can make even things like this work for good." I don't even know why I said it. I wasn't in the mood for preaching at that time. Certainly, God and I weren't on good terms, but I said that. And he got very excited and he looked at me. He said, "What did you say? I can't believe what you just said." And he said to the other guys, he said, "Did you hear what he just said?" And these guys are like, "Yeah, what?" And he says, "I don't go to church. And I don't read the Bible. I couldn't tell you a thing that's in it." He said, "But one verse that I know from when I was a little boy is Romans 8:28, that God can make all things work for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purpose." And that's the message I would like to leave people with. Even our most difficult, most convicting situations in our lives, all the dumb things that we've done, all the stupid things that have happened to us, that we can make that work for good. If we're dedicated to doing that, it's always a choice. It's always a choice
Incredible.
between bitter and better. And I am determined that this isn't going to define me. These things aren't going to define me. That they will be something that will be useful to honor the memory of those that have gone before me.
I love that. And very deep but inspiring.
Thank you.
Very much so. Is there anywhere that both myself and listeners can stay in touch with you, Jeff? Do you have a website or social media handles or anything of that nature?
And I love to do speaking engagements. This is about being our best selves, and that corporate or faith-based, whatever it is, this is about being our best selves in our heads so that we can be the best family members, the best workers, the best community members. And so I love to talk to people. You can find me on my website, jeff-higgins.com. That's jeff-higgins.com. And I'm on Facebook under Jeff Higgins Speaking too. And feel free to reach out, especially maybe if something was meaningful for you. I'd love to hear from you.
Amazing. Well, again, Jeff, I know I've already thanked you so many times for being a guest and sharing your story. and just all of your nuggets of wisdom, but I wanted to truly thank you again for all of those and just simply being who you are and being on the mission to have the conversations and just normalize the struggles, but know that you're not alone and nobody else is alone either.
You're
so
not
I really
alone.
appreciate those.
Absolutely. Did I live up to my what I said, whistlewig, right? What you see is what you get.
You totally did. You totally did. And we all love that. And for that, Jeff, I want to send lots of love to you and to the listeners.
Thank you. Same back to you, Jacqueline. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.